You are about to participate in the most ambitious culinary experiment ever imagined.
This competition is going to test everything.
Adapt quickly to anything. I mean anything. The wildest day of your life starts right now.
All new 24 and 24 Last Chef Standing. Sunday night at 8 on Food Network. Stream on Max.
This is Pop Culture Confidential, and I'm Christina Yerling Biru. Yes, Chef. Hey, everyone, welcome. Now, how great is this? A couple of weeks ago on the show, we did a deep dive into the breakout hit and one of my favorite shows of the summer, The Bear. I talked about how fascinating, frustrating, but affecting the character of Richie is, and what an incredible performance by Eben Moss Bachrach. And guess what? I get to talk to the man himself. I'm thrilled that he wanted to talk to me and was able to take some time from his vacation on a remote island in Europe. And that's why the sound's a bit more muffled than usual, but worth it. He really gets into it with me about his performance, the backstories he developed for Richie, his thoughts on the ending, all the questions I had, and a great number of other things from his career that consists of memorable roles from Lena Dunham's Girls, Marvel's The Punisher, his recent role in The Dropout, and in the upcoming Star Wars series Andor, and of course, season 2 of The Bear, a show chock full of great writing, directing, and acting by all. In the series, Moss Bachrach plays Richie, a sort of unofficially adopted member of the Brizzotto family since he was a kid. As season 1 begins, the youngest member of the family, Carmen Brizzotto, played by Jeremy Allen White, returns to Chicago. Carmi's made a name for himself in the world of fine dining, but has now come home to run the family's Italian beef sandwich shop after his brother Mikey has committed suicide and left the restaurant to him. The show is intense, hot, frustrating, funny, sad, and beautiful. And if you haven't figured it out already, the conversation you're about to hear is full of spoilers.
This is your brother's house. I was running it fine without you.
Why didn't he leave it to you then? Don't wipe your hands on your apron, Chef.
Jeff,
I refer to everybody as Chef because it's a sign of respect.
You could throw down, huh?
So how you gonna pass the family test? Delicious or impressive?
Delicious is impressive.
Word.
Yo, family's up.
I just never had platanos with, like, grass on it.
We want to change this restaurant, right? But we have to change the chemistry.
Hey, why are you always, like, watching me?
Because it's just sort of my job.
We're in a chili flakes. Because it organizes, it's more confusing.
Right there. Label chili flakes.
This is a delicate ecosystem, and it's held together by a shared history and love.
I have every intention of turning this into a respectable place of business. Eventually.
Time to try the new sandwiches.
Yo, this shit looks different.
What do you think?
It's redundant and white, just like you.
So, Eben Moss Bachrach, thank you so much for joining me. Your performance as Richie really affects me a lot, and I have a lot of affection for him, which may say a lot about me. I don't know. Maybe I've had a lot of Richies in my life. Maybe we'll get to that. Of course, he's frustrating. He's a fuck-up. I do think that he's integral to the operation, but you play him with such depth and such nerve that I think even those that find him the most frustrating find compassion in him. And I was thinking there's two performers that have done that. You, with Richie, and John Cazale in several of his characters where he's so frustrating, but at the same time you have all this compassion for him. So I wanted to dive into Richie, how you brought him to life from the script. What was your first impressions and inspirations when you read him on paper?
Well, first let me say, like, the comparison to John Cazale is I don't think is deserved, but is the nicest thing you could have possibly said. He's such a hero of mine for a man that only did a few movies. His work is so iconic and indelible. he's a disaster, right? In The Godfather, he's such a mess, but he's so desperate. And also, I feel like, you know, his needs are so clear and simple in a way, in terms of, you know, I mean, he says it, right? He's like, you know, he's like, I got passed over, right? Isn't that what he says?
Yes.
To Michael, he's like, I'm, you know, he just wants to be taken seriously. He just wants to contribute to the family and be important and integral to the operations of the family. And I guess, you know, with Richie, it's a similar thing. You know, he wants to be valued. You know, these are basic needs, I think, that everybody has. You know, I think a lot of that stuff boils down. There's only just a few basic desires: to be loved, to contribute, to value yourself. You know, there's basic things, I think, that are just driving all of us.
Other night, my kid asked me if my real last name is Bad News.
Bad News, like Bad News Bears?
I guess I'm in her mom's phone as Richie Bad News. I go, Tiff, what the fuck, you know? She says I'm contagious. I only call with bad news. Maybe that's not what you're talking about. Fuck, I don't know. Fuck it all.
I think Richie, like Fredo, I can't believe those words just came out of my mouth. He's a frustrating man, but his kernel, I think, is so relatable and undeniable. So I do think he is sympathetic. A lot of people have a hard time getting there.
I found him such a classic character. I was sort of thinking of, like, it's Kitchen Confidential and Eugene O'Neill. Because as you were saying, there's all these classic things, you know, the dead brother or friend who looms large, the nostalgia over another time. And these are like classic figures in literature and film, from East of Eden to anything, to like Parenthood. Yeah. You know, there's characters like this. Did you bring any that type of inspiration into the story?
Like you say, these are just basic truths, I think, that are just, you know, I didn't research per se. I didn't reread Long Day's Journey into Night or anything, because this stuff is just, like I said, it's like the basic building blocks of humanity and relatability. It's like, don't erase me, you know, time marches on, like, don't forget about me, I'm here, you know, like.
Did you develop a backstory for him?
100%. Yeah, yeah? Of course. I thought, well, like, let's start just with, like, the writing that Christopher Storer and Joanna Callo did was very, this man was very, very clear to me, and I think probably to anyone. He was a man who was deeply grieving, really kind of a mess, struggling. His life was falling apart, and this one place, this small little sandwich shop, is sort of his last. You know, it's his Alamo. You know, it's kind of the last little bit of place where he feels like he can be himself and be valued. So, I definitely did the sort of basic acting work of creating, filling in his life, you know, for myself, you know, his wife, his ex, you know, Tiffany and his daughter, you know, a lot, like, we don't really, as the audience, ever see, like, where Richie lives, not what his house is like. I think.
Is he living in his car?
Yeah, I definitely wanted to have a sense of maybe he's living in his car. I do think he sleeps in his car some of the time. For me, he's somebody whose parents were not really in the picture. I think he grew up with his grandmother. I think he still probably lives in his grandma's basement a little bit. I mean, these are little secrets or fantasies, you know, daydreaming that I came up with, that I felt like his grandma maybe taught piano, was a piano teacher to sort of help pay the rent. And he kind of shared the basement with where she would teach lessons, so he couldn't really be there all the time. I don't know if any of this stuff is interesting. This stuff is interesting. You know, he was written as Polish, and I asked Chris if we could change him to Ukrainian. There's a really big Ukrainian population in Chicago, and the Ukrainian village is really close. There's this great kind of part of Chicago where Ukrainian neighborhood and a Puerto Rican neighborhood and an Italian neighborhood, and also I think a kind of a Polish neighborhood. They all kind of mix and sort of bump up against each other. And I like thinking about this Ukrainian kid sort of becoming this adopted Berzado and sort of being the constant, you know, they would always put a plate out for him in that way of like, oh, they're feeding, you know, they're making pasta for three kids. They might as well just, you know, it's the same as it just one more. And sort of being raised in this Berzado family in this house, sort of, and in many ways, and that was a very dysfunctional house as well. But, you know, Mike, the character of Mikey, I think this guy was like the oldest of three siblings, kind of taking care of them and a real caretaker. And I think that Richie just got kind of swept up into his gravity. And had it not been for Mike, I think his life would be very, very different and kind of scary, I think.
Yeah, Mikey looms large for his brother and for Richie. There's a lot of guilt from Richie's side of not seeing it, the addiction, and from Carmi's side for not being there, or from Richie's side not doing enough about it. What about their relationship, Carmi and Richie?
I think the Carmi-Richie relationship, when they're kids, it's a little less clear to me. You know, you get a little bit of a window into it in that speech, that beautiful speech that Carmi has.
My name is Carmen. My brother's an addict. My brother was an addict. And this morning, I forgot. But before I came to Al-Anon, I was a cook. I mean, I'm still a cook. I'm just a different kind of cook, I guess. My brother and I, we would cook a lot together, especially when we were kids. You know, that's when we were closest. Food was always our common ground. We wanted to open a restaurant together. We had a name, we had a vibe, all of it. My brother can make you feel confident in yourself. You know, like when I was a kid, if I was nervous, I was scared, I wouldn't want to do something, he'd always tell me to just face it, you know, get it over with. He would always say, stupid. He would always say, let it rip. He was loud, and he was hilarious. And he had this amazing ability. He could walk into a room and he could take the temperature of it instantly. You know, he could dial it. And I'm not built like that.
You know, he didn't fit in. Said he never had a girlfriend. He stuttered. And he's also, you know, he's probably something like, I don't know, 7, 8 years younger or something than Richie. Say like Mikey's 12. Richie's 11, 10 or 11. Then you got
Sugar
is like a few years younger, and then Carmi's like this sort of like quiet little meek kid who's just sort of there. And Jeremy's big eyes just kind of like in the corner, you know, just sort of watching, and maybe like with a bag of chips or something, but not really saying that much. And I think Richie and Mike are super loud. It's a loud house.
And there's a lot of protecting going on. My interpretation is that Mikey didn't let Carmi work at the shop because he wanted him to go and do something bigger. And Richie sort of inherited the protection.
I think so. Richie does inherit that protection, but I think that the Carmi-Richie relationship is more complicated than the Carmi-Mikey relationship. There's status and access, right? About like not being a blood member of the family. And a certain jealousy of Carmi that he is truly like a Berzada, and that he rejected the family in a way. I think for that, like that kind of like squandering, he had something and he squandered it. I think it's hard for Richie to forgive that as someone who's a striver and who will never have this thing. I'm curious to see where that relationship obviously goes because, you know, in the first season of The Bear, Richie's not really at a stage where he can like, is capable of like forgiveness or anything.
Even though he did it in his own way, selling coke to make it work during COVID. I mean, he was integral to keeping the place going until Carmi came back. So he, of course, feels like I was running this place well before you showed up.
Yeah, it's something I think about a lot, and I thought about a lot, because it seems like it could be kind of, ideally, they could do it together. It would, you know, I feel like Richie would welcome Carmi in a certain sense. I don't know.
No one is as good with the customers and with the area and with understanding the psychology of where the shop is than Richie. I mean, when he gets out there in front of the shop, he knows everyone's kids. I think Carmi needs that.
Oh, yeah, without a doubt. I mean, well, yeah, I mean, it depends on what happens to the shop. But in terms of it being like a neighborhood place, that's not like something that you can learn in culinary school or anything. That's something that's...
Talk a little bit about the script and the process itself. I understand that the scripts were really tight and really finished when you guys, you know, stepped onto set there. But how much improv does Callow and Store let you work with here?
I don't think that they encouraged improv per se, but they encouraged ownership over the scripts. Really did everything they could to have the actors feel entitled, and really actually everybody on set to feel very valued. You know, they really created a set that was where the food stylists and the cooks and the props and grips and camera department, everyone was felt really emboldened by, you know, this is like top-down kind of stuff. And everyone felt really valued, I think, on that set. And I think there's a kind of a family feeling in the narrative that gets imbued sort of invisibly, osmotically, through people just feeling like family, being treated like a good family there. So in terms of the actors, people were, I wouldn't say encouraged to improvise, but just were allowed to make, you know, we would do several different takes. I personally like to improvise in rehearsal to sort of get a sense of what the parameters are. I was interested, and I think Chris was really interested in pushing things to a level of like acceptable absurdity. I wanted things to be really, at least with Richie, to be really big and loud and almost not fit in the frame. I was sort of relying on Chris to let me know when it was too much. Sometimes things can get so big that they just start to feel a little bit, if the camera is really close, then it just doesn't work. Even though it can feel really truthful to the actor, it can be kind of a mess on camera. Just something I've had to learn over the years through making that mistake.
And like episode 7, which is basically one long take, how many run-throughs did you do of that?
The idea to shoot there without cutting came, I don't know, maybe a couple, 2 or 3 weeks or something before we shot it. They rewrote the script to accommodate that. And then we came in on a Monday after they had worked on it over the weekend, read it a few times, sort of worked on in the space. On a Tuesday, we came in again early in the morning and sort of did the basic moves with our operator Gary, figuring out how, because there's so much choreography to bring cameras around to catch another piece of action, and then somebody has to cross, and you know, is Gary going to push them, or are they going to push Gary, like, you know. And then on a Wednesday morning, we came in at around maybe 6 a.m. and we just jumped in and we started doing takes. I think ultimately that day we did 5 complete takes, and we were done by lunch. I mean, it was crazy. It was going so quickly. And we had a couple, I think twice we got through maybe half or third or half of the way, and we had to cut because of technical stuff. Working like that, it started to take on its own energy. It was like incredibly exciting. And everyone was like, it was like, you know, watching a tennis final. You know, people are like around the monitor. And the further along you go, you know, you get, it's like, oh my God, we've gotten 75% of the way there. No, let's please not screw up. For me, that was great because it imbued it with like real stakes. You know, it's like, and that's like one of the jobs we have as like in like creating fiction is giving it like urgency and real stakes. And that, you know, it became less ephemeral and abstract. You know, people talk a lot of the time about like, oh, that show feels, it was like a play, you know, oh, you know, that movie was really like a piece of theater. And I think that gets tossed around a lot. But as someone who's done a lot of plays, like that was very much like getting in that direction. It did feel like you just had to keep going.
Yeah.
And what I don't like so much about making movies and TV is the lack of that, and that sort of more kind of slow, exploded academic kind of molecular way of working a little is not nearly as thrilling as, you know, getting up and starting and having an experience, a beginning, a middle, and an end, having an experience with an audience, with your scene partners. So much more satisfying at, you know, artistically for me.
And the brilliance about that, when it took me a while to get into, oh wow, I don't think there's any cuts happening here. It's not showy. It's for a different reason. It's to really feel the urgency of what's happening. The same as that the show doesn't have any unnecessary exposition. Everything you see, you, like you were mentioning, we don't go home with Richie. It's just so lean. Someone was saying like a lean piece of beef from the restaurant. I understand, talking about family, that you made a bunch of wonderful tortilla de patatas for the girls.
I love to cook. I would just want to say one more thing about that. Yeah, like, you know, for Chris and Joanna and for all of us, everything is always story motivated. And I admire fancy camera stuff in movies. And I think that movie Russian Ark is really extraordinary. And obviously like Hitchcock's Rope and stuff. But the last thing that we wanted was to have some sort of self-conscious thing where you're reminded of a take all the time. And I love when I hear that people, like, didn't occur to them that it was a wonder, you know, like it really was not trying to do some sort of showy, like flashy kind of thing. It was just, like you said, it just really suited the story. And I'm trying to remember exactly when it happens, but this, you know, the guitar stuff drops in at a certain point. I think it's right after Sydney and Richie have their sort of their little argument at the front of the house. And then this guitar quietly comes in and it slowly builds and it builds and it builds. And it's like a 15-minute thing. And I think it just does a really beautiful job of putting the audience in that space.
Yes.
But I love to make a tortilla española. That's one of my favorites.
My mother was from Valencia, so I grew up on very nice tortilla de patatas.
Yeah, that's amazing.
You like to cook. What did you learn about working in a kitchen from being on this show?
I'm not saying people say this to me, but you hear like a lot, like, wow.
The Vietnam War, it's over.
Your job's just begun.
A new HBO original limited series.
Welcome to the world of spycraft. Strap in.
From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr.
What are you concealing?
Based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel by Viet Thanh Nguyen.
What if I told you that I was a communist spy?
How did you become this?
The Sympathizer, streaming April 14th on Max. Subscription required.
You're an amazing cook. You should open a restaurant. Like, after spending time in a fake kitchen, that's just like the worst idea ever. I would never open a restaurant in my life. And I adore cooking and I love cooking for people. It's so grueling and relentless and hard. And it's like gambling. I mean, the fact that people can marry this really crazy business and their love and passion for cooking and have them both survive and is I think, a really extraordinary thing. Lionel went to Copenhagen for like 2 weeks and studied like baking with Richard Hart, who's an incredible baker, who I really am like, I would love to like do something like that. But I'm sort of happy not to have to deal with any of that stuff.
Yeah, you didn't have to chop a lot. Everyone was chopping so much.
I mean, you know, it's cool, like fundamentals of acting classes, you know, it's always about like doing like a basic activity. I remember when I was like, doing sort of basic like first year Meisner training stuff, you know, you have to have like some kind of complicated activity that you'd be doing, trying to knit something or write something that was not intellectual and more physical, and then try to do a scene while doing this stuff. And what happens, it really kind of shortens your fuse in a way. It's a real gift, I think, for an actor to have to be doing something. Also, it's nice to be physical activity that grounds you in reality. You know, I'm always looking for something to be doing. So making a show in a restaurant is kind of amazing. I think it instantly makes everyone like a much better act. It's uniquely suited for that.
Yeah. Now, this is a very Chicago show. You seem very New York. You've lots of theater and you went to Columbia University and, of course, Girls. When did you start acting?
I did a little bit in high school and I studied, I took a class, a scene study class, and that really turned me on. And a really wonderful teacher, this woman called Joan Rosenfels, who was just this great acting teacher who was at Barnard. I think maybe because we were in the city in New York, she was just this. And then I spent that summer, I went as an apprentice to the Williamstown Theater Festival, just sort of see what that was like. And I ended up having this transformative summer where they did this production of a play called Dead End, which is like a Sidney Kingsley play from the 30s. They made a movie out of it starring Humphrey Bogart. And like, I ended up getting this really great part in it. And I was working with all these amazing actors like Hope Davis and Campbell Scott, and Marion Seldes, and Robert Sean Leonard. There was like, I was just all of a sudden, I was like doing scenes with these people. It completely changed my life. And I remember like just talking to Hope Davis and saying like, I think I'm gonna like, this is incredible. I'm gonna change my major. I was studying American history, so I'm gonna change my major. I'm gonna just study theater. And she was like, no, don't do that. Study, learn, become like, learn how to be a person like normal people. Don't just study theater so that's all you can draw from. Like,
smart.
Yeah, very, like, very good advice. Thank you, Hope, yeah.
And music-wise, will we be hearing anything more from Big Buck Hunter, your band with Peter Sarsgaard?
Big Buck Hunter, we haven't played anything for a long time. I know, it's so hard, you know, like, we were playing music before we were kids. Fred, we'll still play music every once in a while. We're neighbors. Our daughters will play together sometimes. That's a deep reference. I can't believe you. I haven't heard that for a long time.
Well, there's something very romantic about seeing you and your wife with an amazing visual artist and Maggie Gyllenhaal and Peter Sarsgaard, all of you guys in Brooklyn. It's like, let's see that movie.
Yeah, music is still very, very important to me. My daughters are really great. My older daughter has a beautiful voice and she's a very good pianist. I'm really proud of her. Peter has two daughters as well, and his older daughter Ramona is really great. She's a great oboist, but she's also been playing a lot of accordion recently. And his little daughter Gloria is like a really great violinist. So there's a lot of music still. Like, where, you know, me and my family were traveling for like a couple months. I have a little ukulele with me, you know, embarrassing and
no, it's very Steve Martin.
At best, yeah.
But I mentioned girls. Desi, so he's a douche, but I mean in a different way than Richie. But both of these two shows, they really sort of hit the zeitgeist tremendously. Why do you think that is?
You know, I came into Girls late in the... So it was already very much a thing by the time I showed up. I think that Girls was just personal in a way that people hadn't experienced, and confessional and personal, naked, you know, in a way that probably TV hadn't been before. Sort of created a new way of storytelling that so many other shows are now. It sort of like opened the door for so many other shows. With The Bear, you know, we all thought we were making something pretty special, but I had no idea if anyone was going to watch it. But for me, I think it's just such a people being together in a small space, making food together, yelling at each other. And it's just like, God, I can't tell you how nice it was to make it coming through COVID, you know, and just being so isolated from everybody. And I mean, I was fortunate enough to work a lot. The other experiences I had working during COVID were really very masked up, very antithetical to what I love about my job, which is it's a collaborative art, it's a collaborative medium, you know, you're together, you have dinners, you're in a location somewhere. It's like a found family little thing. You make little families, and it's a really quick way of becoming quite intimate with people, and I really enjoy that. COVID was very hard to create that kind of trust when everyone was like behind shields and masks and you know, and so when we got to Chicago to make the show, we got very lucky, and we made it in this window when things were relatively safe and the numbers were low, and we always had to wear masks when we weren't working together, but it was relaxed in a way that nothing else had been. So I guess this is my long-winded, sorry, digressive way of like answering your question. It just felt like something very intimate, and I think that people really respond for that.
I mean, I know everything is super top secret, but it is out that you're going to be in Andor, which I'm sure was the opposite of this intimate production. What is that like?
But I mean, I've definitely, you know, I've worked with Marvel before, and I've worked on big budget things, but like that's just so much more of you shouldn't even call it the same job. I mean, it should have a different name. I mean, you know, it's just, you know, if I was like a small branch of a local bank, would feel more like making the Bear than making a Star Wars thing. They're so massive. But I mean, I will say that, you know, with Star Wars, attracting me the most was Tony Gilroy. You know, just such a great writer and director, and I'm such a huge fan of his. And I don't think he's really much of a Star Wars fan. And I think he was interested in making something that felt a lot more relatable and maybe with less kind of super shiny, sexy objects in space and more people and more character driven. And it kind of seems that that's he pulled that off from the trailer that I've seen. I love when people are playing with genre and surprise and use genre and people's expectations in a way that can like subvert it and toy with that. I think that's super interesting. Even something like Young Frankenstein, you know, like,
yes,
playing with the conventions. I mean, that's like one of my favorite movies. So I think it's harder to do that in something like Star Wars, but maybe Marvel's been doing that. I mean, I didn't see WandaVision or something. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Is that what it's called? But I hear that does something like that. And I'm really excited to see like Greta Gerwig's like the Barbie movie.
That's like the one, yeah, top of my list. That's going to be the most, yeah, coolest subversive thing we've ever seen.
I saw like just a picture of Ryan Gosling's like frosted hair, and I was like, oh yeah, this is gonna be good.
I know I'm taking way more of your time than I was supposed to, but I just have a couple more questions about Richie.
Yeah, sure. No, it's a pleasure talking to you, Christine. I'm happy to chat.
Oh, great. He always has dirty fingernails. Was that something you, yeah, thought of, and why?
The fingernail thing is, you know, it's about, and I think I maybe went a little bit too far with it actually, but they read a little bit darker than I want them to. It's, you know, it's about his transience and dude that is maybe not really getting a chance to take care of himself or shower or you know, I mean, you thought that maybe he was living in his car, and like that was kind of my goal with that, you know, was to, I think he's like, you know, I had this like had this image of like somebody looking for, you know, digging through your car, like the car seat, you know, getting your hand back in between the seat cushions in the back of your car, like looking for a lighter, or you know, searching for like money or whatever back there. I just kind of got into that visual, and we made his fingernails dirty. But if I had to go back, I probably wouldn't have made them quite so dirty.
We had a lot of discussions about the ending. Why did he put the money there, and is it Cicero's money, or has he been stealing money? Do you have your own thoughts on what this money is and what Mikey was hoping would happen with it?
To say what I think, it's definitely like an addict thing to do, to stash a bunch of money like this. Yeah, I mean, I think it was probably, you know, money that he owed Cicero. So my way of thinking, you know, it's this, he's giving a gift, you know, to Carmen. The thing I find the most interesting about it is that the amount of time that it took to set up this sort of farewell and this, you know, and how long had he been planning this exit, you know, and that is so, I find so sad, because suicide is always just so unspeakably sad and tragic. But for this man to think about Mike and think about a man sort of putting aside money, this prolonged, you know, it's not a moment of grief and confusion and feeling overwhelmed and ending it. It's so slow and so painful and so lonely to be having this, to be living with this plan that he had for so long. It makes me really sad. Yeah. You know?
Yeah, he must have been living with this pain for such a long time.
And it's really, you get a sense of like responsibility that Mikey feels for Carmy and for his family to, you know, specifically Carmi. Like, it's just, it's a really profound act.
But Carmi still owes Cicero.
Yeah, he does, but that's what's crazy. But, you know, but these, I mean, they already, you know, this is what I, when I talk about a restaurant, I talk about gambling, you know, I mean, they have the money right there to pay him back. And I don't even think he thinks about paying him back even for a second. You know, they're going to try and make some other kind of restaurant. And I imagine it's going to be even more of a disaster.
So finally, when do you start filming season two, and what are your hopes for Richie in particular?
I think it'd be nice for Richie to find some companionship. I don't know. I mean, I think it's really fun to play this guy as, like, you know, with his back against the wall. It's really fun to act this man who's like him against the world. So I hope he doesn't get too relaxed or anything. I don't think he will. I don't really see him settling down and having like a calm relationship with a nice girl from the neighborhood. But and I think we start, hopefully, I think we start soon. I think we start probably sometime in January or February. I don't know. They haven't told me. I'm on the other side of the world right now from all this stuff. So I don't know.
Evan, I'm going to let you go to your, what seems like a magical island there with your family. And thank you so much for taking your time on your vacation. I really appreciate it.
Of course. Such a pleasure.
Thank you so much to Eben Moss-Bachrach. The Bear is on FX Hulu and is rolling out all over Europe and other territories really soon. And thank you so much for listening. Please subscribe to Pop Culture Confidential, a part of the Evergreen Podcast Network, wherever you get your podcasts. See you next time.
In a world infatuated with comic fandom, comes a show to help us remember the talents that have inspired us.
Whoa, 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 cut.
Oh, come on, it wasn't that bad.
It's a bit dramatic. Let's just tell them about the show, guys.
We are the Canned Air Podcast.
Join us weekly for a comedic trip through pop culture.
We also welcome some cool comic creators, as well as some of the voice and screen actors that helped shape your childhood.
Find us on cannedairpodcast.com and on the Evergreen Podcast Network.